Hi, nice to have you back with us, Bruce Jenkins. Good morning. How are you today?
Doing well, Marty. How's it going?
Well, I think it's going well. What a week of baseball. First of all, the first 6-7 weeks of baseball, I think, have been terrific. I think those division races, which we'll touch on in a minute, have been fabulous. And I think we've got a good summer ahead of us. But what a week of celebrating Willie Mays. And the Chronicle did a great job. Bruce, you did a great job. And just to sum it up on this Saturday, the feelings that you had this week about Willie.
Well, you know, it's just terrific that one of the all-time greats in any sport gets honored to such an extent, you know, while he or she is still alive. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, the appreciation level of Mays' life is really it's so much in focus right now. It's absolutely wonderful. It's just so great that he can soak all of this in. I was really proud of the Chronicle's work, especially, you know, we all reached out to famous people that we knew, and, you know, leading off with Barack Obama, we've got just dozens of notable folks talking about Willie Mays, because he meant something to everybody in a way. He touched everyone. His play touched them. They may not have ever met him or seen him up close, but they know about him. He comes to life on all the old videos and films, and it's just been an absolutely fantastic thing.
Yeah, we've seen his whole his whole life, but his whole baseball life. The kid who played stickball with the kids in Harlem, eating ice cream right up to the 73 World Series and the play at the plate.
Yeah, the stickball stuff is great. I mean, you can imagine, you know, everybody kind of wants a piece of Willie's time, but he always looked out for the kids. He knew that the kids idolized him, and he'd go into Harlem and play stickball with these kids, and, you know, talk about a great memory. But he really loved it. He wasn't like, oh, you know, maybe somebody will get a photo of this. You know, he couldn't care less. He wanted to go out there, and because he was a little kid at heart in a lot of ways. He played the game with a childlike enthusiasm.
Well, it's great to see it. And like you say, to celebrate his life while he's with us.
Yeah.
It was just fabulous to see him last night. And it was good. I have wonderful memories with him, and I've had wonderful experiences with him. And I always told him, I'd like to have played stickball against you because I came from Brooklyn. I could have handled you. And of course,
absolutely. Take one deep down to the next alley.
The next sewer, as we like to. Boy. What a 32 games of the Giants, Bruce. They're right there. I swear to you, I get the 2010 feeling because the league itself is not hitting. And in 2010, the steroids sort of went out of baseball and the Giants pitching took over. And I kind of get the same feeling now, but they have an MVP right now in the catcher who's gone beyond anything he's ever done in Buster Posey.
Yeah, it's really a terrific thing just to watch it, you know, keep going. You know, now he homers to right last night. My goodness. I mean, if you ever needed any evidence about his leg strength, his hip strength returning, being able to handle a pitch like that to that extent, you know, that was a pretty good answer. Absolutely. I mean, the league is not hitting, and when they face the Giants, you know, they're not hitting. I mean, another good start. DeSclafani wasn't tremendous, but he had a pretty good outing. But I'll tell you, Marty, I think one thing that's going to be big is going to be the relief pitching, because the Dodgers really have a problem there. There's no secret that they're searching. And the Giants, if they can set up Doval to Rogers to McGee like they did last night with those kinds of results and rely on that, you know, that's going to be huge. I mean, McGee, you know, the last time out, he threw something like 91. He wasn't feeling well. He got right back to 96 last night. He strikes out the side in the ninth. You know, Rogers was great. And you know, Duvall he went 1-2-3 in the seventh, and he strikes out Tatis on a fastball. So that was just overpowering, impressive relief. And that's a big edge that Giants are going to have on a lot of teams if it continues.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the big question for them as we go through the rest of this season, of course, the rest of this month, and what you're going to get with Duvall and Rogers. First of all, can he pitch 100 games? He's going to have to pitch 100 games. and McGee is literally all over the place, but when he puts the ball where he wants to put it, He's tough to catch, and he got the right end of the lineup last night for the Padres.
Yes, he did. He got Caratini and Profar and Kim at the end there.
Yeah, thank good, thank goodness. Yeah. Because I said to myself, if he walks Kim and he's got to deal with Grisham, this is not good.
Oh, man. Yeah, Grisham, but, he went out earlier.
No, it's like Forrest Gump with the box of chocolates. You know, you never know what you're going to get with the bullpen, and that's the issue. But I say this, Farhan will, and the whole crowd, they will go through as many relievers as they have to get it right. And that's what I like about this ball club. They somehow get it right.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think Duvall can be huge. I mean, he throws absolute heat. He's got a good slider. And, you know, they thought he went to the slider a little too much the last outing, you know, obviously. But he trusted the fastball there on Tatis at 97 miles an hour to end that inning. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, talk about a confidence builder. He's a guy, again, you want to see how it plays out. But I think I certainly think they've got more good feelings about the way things are going to go than a lot of teams, including the Dodgers.
I like Maurice Dubon in the infield.
Yes, very much so. He's smooth.
Isn't he?
He's not perfect out there, but he's got really good hands, good arm, and, you know, he loves to do it. He loves to be in that spot playing shortstop. You know, he knows Crawford's the man, and they have nice exchanges in the dugout, but he's an entertainer. I've mm-hmm. always liked Dubon.
Yep, much better than in the outfield for me. And just let him play the infield and be a backup, because you can't put Flores and Lestel out there all the time. They're both injured.
No, and yeah. You know, as great as it is that you never know where you're going to see Dubon. He could be anywhere on any given night, except maybe not on the mound. But you know, he deserves to have a little bit of idea of what his role is. And if you narrow it down to short and second, I think that would, like you say, keep him in the infield. Mm-hmm. Because you need the reps. You know, next thing you know, it's August, September, Crawford's out, and he's got a big play to make. You know, and it just helps to have made a whole bunch of them before that.
Absolutely. And you need the speed in the infield, especially with the shift. You can't have your second baseman playing in short right field if he has no range. And this kid's got range. So I think that's the future for him. Looking at couple of things. One, if you're a right-handed hitter today, I think you sort of stay home or you call in sick. Between Musgrove and Gausman, right-handed hitters are 15 for 116. How about that?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, now that Miley's thrown a no-hitter, it's just a matter of who throws one tonight. Those two guys, talk about right-handers, Scherzer and Jose Berrios and Luis Castillo are all going tonight. So who you got for tonight's no-hitter?
Carlos Martinez. How about him?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, but, yeah, that's not a good day to be a right-hand hitter in the Giants ball game, without a doubt.
No, it's amazing what these two will do. But, well, you know, Gausman is the key, Bruce. He's the ace.
Yeah.
And this is an ace day because you're going again. Musgrove was not good last Sunday, and the arm looks a little tired for whatever reason, and Gausman's had the groin and this and that. So it's a big game for him today.
No, very much so, and I would expect a great outing. He's really delivered. He's got a great look about him in the dugout. He's confident. He's got all of his pitches working. The team's doing great. You know, they're in first place, for heaven's sake. So, yeah, all good. I would expect another.
This is a good weekend. And then tomorrow, of course, you and I will talk tomorrow around the same time. We've got Cueto tomorrow going tomorrow, and I'm not sure who the Padres have announced, if they've even announced a starter for tomorrow. But Cueto tomorrow, so we'll get that going again. Did you follow what happened in New York last night? Only in New York.
What?
Can Lindor and McNeil get into some beef because the play wasn't made? Lindor, of course, the shortstop. Lindor, the shortstop, McNeil, second base. They get in the tunnel, and the things have to be broken up, and they claim they were looking at a rat or a raccoon.
And, you know, obviously it was a hippopotamus in there. It wasn't a rat or a raccoon. But yeah, I mean, they did make light of it later. You know, they both had genuine looks of sort of, you know, good-humored reaction to it because they had to get up to the podium and explain that. But, I mean, the whole team went, you know, barreling down the tunnel to see what was going on. I think some fists were flying in there for a little bit. But, yeah, you know, it's the Mets – it's just being in New York, there's always that undercurrent of tension, you know. Everything, it's either the greatest thing in the world or, oh, my God, the world is coming to an end. And I think they managed to defuse that, and, you know, they won the game. And Lindor had a big game other than that. So, but we'll see how that goes. Lindor is one of my favorite guys to watch. I mean, my goodness, his whole career, he's been great. I think he was like 0 for 24 recently, and you feel like, geez, what's going on with this guy? But, you know, a switch hitter, he's going to be fine.
Well, $350 million in New York, you got to be better than fine.
You know? You really do. You got to be the Pope.
Yeah, you do. And that's the deal. And look, it's only and they're right there. And it's only about 30 games in, and they're already booing the guy. And he's having a fight with McNeil out of something happened on the field. So this is a story, believe me, to be watched. This is
one, no doubt.
This
no
is
doubt.
The back page of the New York Daily News. I can't wait to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Boswell of the Washington Post retired, and I got a lot of notes about it. And I said, you and I would absolutely talk about it. I love his columns. What a feel for baseball, and life begins on opening day. And your thoughts about Tom Boswell?
Yeah, I just really admired him. Got to know him pretty well over the years. You know, when I covered the A's in the early 80s, we made routine trips to Baltimore, and one of my favorite things was watching him work, you know, not like over his shoulder, but like reading. You know, he would write running columns, a column that would have to be in by a certain time. Sometimes the game wasn't even over, but at the very least, it was right after the game ended. And, you know, those running columns can be a little dicey, you know, especially if the ninth inning turns the tables on everything you've already written. And he wrote these brilliant, brilliant pieces that could stand alone, like, for the rest of the night. You know, they were so well written. He understood the game so well. And then he'd start over and write another great column about, you know, how it actually happened, and with some quotes in there. But I always remember Tom from the 89 earthquake. After everything settled down, he and Kenny Rosenthal had taken a cab out there, and they had no idea what they were going to do. And I did have a car, and I was going to go back to the Chronicle and try to somehow file a story. And they piled into my car with me, and we drove down 3rd Street, which was a harrowing experience in itself. Mm-hmm. We didn't even know where we were. It's like, I actually remember Boswell going, where are we? Were you in San Francisco? I don't know. what kind of a turn did we make here? And we all got our stories written somehow. But, you know, Tom, 52 years, my goodness, what a great career. He'll be in the Hall of Fame, and I'm sure there's going to be many tributes coming his way.
Yeah, you ought to be there with him. We haven't started the campaign yet, but people like yourself and Boswell, they're the heart of baseball.
Well, he definitely was. I mean, I loved about him is that he was never one to go, you know, get this game over with or complaining about this or that. He just loved to study the game. He knew so much about it that he could watch a game and see things and bring things to the public that not your ordinary journalist was going to be able to do. And he did it, you know, just about every time he sat down to write.
Well, a couple of historical notes. Of course, Bruce Jenkins with us. Today is the end. Look, we almost had the perfect game last night in Oakland with Frankie Montas. This is the anniversary, 1968, of Catfish and his perfect game against the Minnesota Twins.
Yeah, what a thing. I mean, the A's had just gotten there. It was their first year in Oakland. And they had a few of the pieces. They had Campy and Reggie Jackson and Bando and Rudy. They were all in the lineup that day. But the interesting thing about that, one of the interesting things, is that the Twins' leadoff hitter that day was Cesar Tovar, who's like the all-time notorious, you know, crusher of no-hitters. I mean, this is a guy who had the only hit in five different games. He wrecked in one season. He spoiled no-hitters by Dave McNally and Mike Cuellar in the ninth inning in '69. He did that to those two guys. He got Catfish after Catfish went to the Yankees. He got him with a single in the sixth. It was the only hit that Catfish allowed that day. But nobody was getting to Catfish this day. And, you know, God, they had Carew and Killebrew and Oliva in that lineup. And he could hit, Marty.
Yes.
Catfish hit .350 one year and 103 at-bats for the A's. And he had three hits that day, including an RBI single off Ron Piranowski. So that was a tremendous day. That was, you know, a good way to get the A's fans thinking, hey, we got a nice little team here.
And unfortunately, not a lot of film of that game, because in those days you had to rush back to the studio with the canister to get it developed so you could put it on the news at night. So they didn't see the end of the game.
And then it probably wasn't saved. And there's so much footage from the 60s, even at the big networks, you know, big events that, oh, geez, we threw it away or it got lost. It's like, come on now. Where is it? But, yeah, I know, and you're right. There's no real visuals that I've ever seen of that game.
No. Boy, what a player. What a player, Catfish, in the 1968, the perfect game. One other one, the Phillies released, this is 1986, the Phillies released Dave Stewart on this day, and then he signs with the A's, and the rest, as they like to say, is history.
Yeah. Well, you know, he'd had a tough go of it. I don't think it was terribly surprising that the Phillies released him. You know, he'd been arrested on a sort of an unsavory event, and he'd had surgery, and he didn't work out with Texas. He tried to go to Tokyo, but he couldn't leave the country because he was still on probation from his arrest, and he was terrible out of the Phillies bullpen, and nobody wanted him. And the A's, you know, offered him a Triple-A deal, and the quote from Sandy Alderson was something like, you know, I can't say our expectations are substantial because they aren't. but they sent him to Tacoma, and they call him up, and, you know, two people were really important there. Dusty Baker was on the team at that time, and he actually talked Stewart out of quitting, because when they sent him to Tacoma, Stewart figured, you know, this is just it for me. I'm not going to do this. But Dusty Baker told him to gut it out, and then Tony La Russa literally had just come on board with the A's that July to manage the team, replacing Steve Boros. And he started Stewart in a nationally televised game, I think, in the first week of July. He got a decent start out of it. He started working with Dave Duncan, and by the 87 through 1990, he was somebody they say, who'd you put out there if your life depended on it? You know, I've always gone Koufax, but Dave Stewart's right there.
Well, if the opponent was Roger Clemens, I would put Dave Stewart out there, I'll tell you that.
Oh, my God, every time.
Remember what they used to do? Stu was on the mound, and they put a cutout of, you know, like the cutouts they had last year, they put a cutout of Roger Clemens so he could see it. And
I was going to say, they should put a chalk line of Clemens out on the mound there. Here lies the guy who can never beat Dave Stewart.
Yeah, Stu really took care of him in big games, too.
Oh, yeah, in Fenway. Oh, my God, it's amazing.
Boy, amazing. Bill Lasky joins us. Bill, Dave Stewart, 1986. You were still around then. Do you remember Stu then?
Yeah, I did. I remember Stu when he was with the Dodgers. He was outstanding. Yeah. Then he went over to the Phillies. But talk about resurrection of his career going to the Oakland A's, the stare down and, you know, all the things he did on the mound. He was just a superior pitcher. And now, you know, he's one of the great analysts the Oakland A's have. I love listening to him when he talks about pitching. But today, Bruce, I want to talk and go back to New York. And a good friend of all three of us, Chili Davis, got fired. And, of course, he got pushed out of the Cubs, Chicago, because Rizzo and Baez didn't like how he was teaching hitting from going to right field to left field. So he got picked up by the Mets. And I talk to Chili 3-4 times a year, usually during the season and in the off season. But he really felt he was good with the New York Mets. Pete Alonso loved him, called him Uncle Chili, called Slater Uncle Slate. And he read it on Twitter, and literally he was crying in his locker because he felt it was so abusive, more or less, because all the team players loved Chili, and he just didn't understand what management was doing. And in that, he went to management and asked him why, and management really just kind of blew him off. I'd like to hear both of your thoughts on Chili Davis as an old-time hitting coach, because that's how Chili taught, and get both of your perspectives on it.
Well, I always thought he'd be a terrific hitting coach, and he has been for several teams because he was a switch hitter. He had the track record, and he has a great way about him, extremely pleasant, forthcoming, very, very believable guy. And you know, this is one of those things where – well, we're not going to fire the manager. Who are we going to dump? Mm-hmm. You know, the general manager actually said it's not about results. what else is it going to be? It's like a vision of what our hitting program to be, which is just complete crap. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel really bad for Chili, but he knows the deal. He's been bounced around. He's gotten a lot of kudos for jobs that he did. But when you're a hitting coach in the game, stuff like this can happen that's just beyond your control. And I mean, you know him pretty well. Do you think he'll try to continue, or does he think maybe he might be done, or just in from his own standpoint?
Yeah, I haven't reached out to him. You know, it's always so tender when things happen, but I'll get back to him and talk to him. I know last year he didn't travel with the team in a 60-game season. He was at home, but he was doing work through computer and Zoom and setting up different hitting things. And he really loved the Mets. He really enjoyed coaching there. And he just kept telling me, you know, this is the place that's listening to me. They're learning how to hit. You know, when I was looking at the National League hitting, they're hitting 14th, the team. Team batting 14 out of 30 teams. I'm just like, what's going on? So I don't know, and I think both you and Marty both said it's management. It's not about what they want. It's about, you know, who they want to improve on. But they bring up a minor league hitting coach. That's what I was shaking my head too. So I don't know if they're going to make more changes there or not.
You're going to want to follow the back page of the tabloids if they continue to struggle. One of the guys they brought up is named Quattlebaum. Seriously.
Yes, it is. Last time I saw him, he was at DMV. He was deciding cases. But that was many years ago. Frank, I hope you're still around. He was a nice man. Well, you know, for me, it's New York, Bill. It's New York, and he didn't travel last year, and of course you got the new manager there, and now the team is not hitting. Lindor is the $330 million man. He's hitting under 200, and they came up with a fictional hitting coach, the hitters. They came up with someone named Stevenson. They were making believe he was the hitting coach.
It was Adlai Stevenson.
Yeah, probably. He probably could do a better job than this Stevenson. So it got a little goofy. And, again, it's New York. It's analytics. And Chile has been successful in so many different places that I don't think he's got anything to worry about. But it is the life of a hitting coach in today's world. You better understand the launch angle, and you better understand all the analytics that go with it. And we've seen the success that the Giants have had, and that's the game today.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, Chile, that's not where he comes from, and I'm sure he'll adopt a lot of that stuff and has, but in essence, that's not where he comes from. It's not where Dusty Baker comes from. So, you know, they're naturally going to impart what they know, what's been successful with, you know, untold hitters that they've taught over the years, and it's not that that's wrong. But if you don't, you know, really 100% embrace a new approach that the team is taking, it can be a little uncomfortable.
Mm. Boy, great. Great stuff, Bruce. Jason Stark, Bruce, is going to join us next and talk about the column he writes in The Athletic, the weird, wacky stuff of baseball. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Well, yeah, he writes it with such flair. I mean, he's eternally amazed by what happens in the game, as we all are. I mean, it's just almost every day something completely incomprehensible happens. But he's in charge of these things. He's our man to go to for the wacky world of baseball.
Yeah, John Means, who pitched the no-hitter this week, lost the perfect game on a third strike that was a wild pitch and was not caught. He's never had that happen to him in his life, in his professional life, ever. And it happened in the day he pitched a no-hitter. How about that? So, you know, it's that kind of stuff. But
exactly.
Yeah, we'll enjoy it.
Jason is great, and he's a great interview as well, so that should be fun.
Yeah, I enjoy it. All right, Bruce, we'll talk to you tomorrow morning.
Thanks, Bruce.
Okay, talk then, guys. Thanks a million.
All right, Bill, sit back, Bill. You're going to enjoy this with Jason Stark
as
we go through some of the crazy things that happen in baseball. More coming up right here on the Sports Leader.